Okay, so. Hey, welcome to the great experiment called Deep Geek Live. My name is James Drew, and I'm your host, along with my co-host Tim Callender. Hi, Tim.
Hello. Hi, how are you doing, James?
Doing really good. We thought we'd give this a try. This is our third episode of the Deep Geek series, where we do an in-depth discussion of the Apollo missions. Our first two missions were the Apollo 7 mission, and then the Apollo 8 mission. Tonight, we thought we'd try something different and do the live broadcast of Deep Geek Live and take phone calls. So if you're listening in, please feel free to give us a call at 347-215-7847 and talk Apollo 9. So, Tim, what are your thoughts on Apollo 9?
Well, you know, Apollo 9, I think, is one of those missions that ends up being forgotten by a lot of people because it's not nearly as glamorous as, say, landing on the moon. It certainly wasn't as apparently daring to do as Apollo 8, which was the first voyage to the moon. But really, when you look at it, especially up to that point in time in the Apollo program, was arguably one of the most ambitious missions ever put together.
Yeah, it was. When you consider that it was the first testing of the lunar module, the first testing of the Pliss backpack, the first docking of two spacecraft, the first going 100 miles away, reacquiring and redocking the spacecraft. They had a lot to do.
Yeah, and add to that the fact that the lunar module, which had never been tested in any way, shape, or form, unmanned or otherwise, it's also being tested in Earth orbit. Now, what's interesting about that is, of course, that the lunar module had no heat shield. So,
no, something had gone wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
It definitely would have been.
Yeah, when you consider in the lunar mission profiles, there was a cookbook, if I recall right, that was given to the command module pilots that in a number of circumstances and at certain altitudes, the command module pilot was expected to go down and make rendezvous with the troubled lunar module. I don't know that they had such a cookbook in place for Apollo 9, and I'm not sure that those kinds of altitudes would have been possible anyways to make any rescues at, given the fact that you're dealing with an atmosphere and a much larger body.
Well, not to mention that the original mission of Apollo 9 wasn't even supposed to be what it ended up being. You know, the original mission profile, as stated, at least on Wiki, states that the Apollo 9 was supposed to be the second manned Apollo mission. It was supposed to be a D mission and would have a manned CFM launched on a Saturn 1B, and then the lunar module launched later, a day later, on another Saturn 1B and practice orbiting rendezvous. But McDivitt, Scott, and Schweigert were given the mission, with Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and William Anders being assigned to a similar Earth orbit test, the E mission, using the Saturn V, which would carry both the CSM and the LEM. So it really was kind of a Apollo 9 was kind of, they decided, let's just put both of those together, just let them take the Saturn V, and then we'll just send Apollo 8 to the moon.
Was that decision made in the wake of the Apollo 8 decision?
Well, that depends. I remember watching From the Earth to the Moon, and for those who listen to me a lot doing these podcasts, you know I reference From the Earth to the Moon a heck of a lot. the way the storyline goes in there, and it's just a movie, but that McDivitt was actually consulted and offered the mission before they talked to, or you know Jim, what do you think? This is what we want to do, and he says I'd rather keep my mission, and Frank Borman then got the Apollo 8 mission.
Yeah, and that's in A Man on the Moon, the Andrew Chaikin book that was source material for From Earth to the Moon. So yeah, that's what happened, and that's another interesting thing. The reason McDivitt wanted to keep his mission is because he was a test pilot's test pilot, and
right.
Apollo 8, as dangerous as it was and as high profile as it was, really wasn't a whole lot of flying going on.
No, it was just a whole lot of traveling.
Right, exactly.
I like what the character of Rusty Schreikert says in that. He says, you know, I like our mission. It's, you know, we're going to have fun.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting you say that, because I went and managed to find a whole lot of audio out on the one of the NASA sites of the Apollo 9 mission. And
you mean like this?
1 minute and counting. T-minus 55 seconds and counting. All still going well. We're coming up on the power transfer. Mark,
this is the Apollo 9 liftoff.
We're now on internal power with the three stages and instrument unit of the Saturn V. All propellant tanks in the second stage now pressurized. 35 seconds and counting. The vehicle now completely pressurized. The vents closed. We are go. 30 seconds and counting. T-minus 25 seconds and counting. All aspects still
Contact
go at this
network,
time as the computer monitors. 20 seconds.
Miles go.
GBM go.
Bermuda.
Guidance release. 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9. We have ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engines running. Commit. Liftoff. We have liftoff at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Apollo 9, you are go all the way. Everything looks good.
Roger. Hi, Houston. Did you read our comment that our SPS helium pressure went to zero? Indicated zero at liftoff.
And that's the liftoff of Apollo 9. We'll be playing a couple of different clips during the show to relive that mission, which launched 40 years ago, the crew of James McDivitt, the commander, David R. Scott, the command module pilot, and Russell Schweikert, the lunar module pilot. The backup crew was Charles Conrad, Pete Conrad Jr., Richard F. Gordon Jr., the command module pilot, and Alan Bean, the lunar module pilot.
You know, here's something interesting. Now, this isn't directly related to Apollo 9, but I went back and was rereading A Man on the Moon, and the fact that McDivitt decided to allow his mission to be bumped one back meant that Pete Conrad was no longer necessarily in line to be the first man on the moon.
Interesting. So because of Jim McDivitt's decision, Pete Conrad ended up being the third man to walk on the moon.
Correct.
As opposed to first.
Correct.
Interesting.
Yeah, because they were assigned to the backup crew. Neil Armstrong and his crew were backup crew to Borman's crew. And when those two missions were swapped, the backup crews were swapped as well. And as it says in the book, Conrad had figured out there was a three-mission delay. When you were a backup crew, it would be the third mission down that you would then be assigned the prime crew. And that's how he ended up on Apollo 12.
But I got to tell you, just as a brief little bit, I love the Apollo 12 mission. It was a lot of fun. Now,
yeah,
let's go back
to talk about that one. No doubt.
Yeah, I can't wait till we geek Apollo 12. That's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But back to nine,
and again with you know, I'm sure we'll hear this as you play the cuts. When you listen to those guys sound like they're genuinely having fun.
Well, let's face it, they had a lot to do. If we go over the mission highlights here, it was the first space test of the complete Apollo spacecraft, including the lunar module, the first space docking with an internal crew transfer. For 10 days, the astronauts put all three Apollo vehicles through their paces in Earth orbit, docking and then redocking and undocking the lunar lander with command modules. They would be in lunar orbit. And it was the first testing of the Plus backpack. There was also both Schweikert and Scott performed a spacewalk, so it was the first two-man spacewalk in space. The first to have its own life support system rather than be dependent on an umbilical connection. First photo safari in space as Dave Scott filmed Schweikert out on the steps of the lunar module as he tested the Plus backpack. Later test flew the LN and the first separation of the lunar module in space, along with docking maneuvers of the lunar module, also known as Gumdrop, and Schweikert called it Gumdrop because when it was wrapped up in the blue cellophane, for lack of a better term, that they used to protect the command module in during transport to the Cape, it looked like a big gigantic gumdrop, and the name kind of stuck.
And of course, the LEM was called Spider for obvious reasons.
So there was a heck of a lot to do with these two. And
it's amazing that it performs so flawlessly. I mean, that's the other interesting thing when you think about some of the Gemini missions, which ran into a variety of troubles, both major and minor, and you think about subsequent Apollo missions, which had their own issues on a technical nature. Apollo 9, for a full mission, was relatively trouble-free.
I think the
biggest problem was that Schweikert got spacesick, and it looked like that was going to scrub his EVA.
Yeah, I was just about to say, it's really, and it kind of is kind of sad that Schweikert never got to go in space again. Mm-hmm. And there's always been kind of a question as to whether the reason he didn't get to ever go back again was because of the fact that he got space sick. The only other one that I remember that got space sick was Frank Borman, and I don't think he really wanted to go back up.
No, And
He knew he wasn't going to be the first to walk on the moon, and he probably wouldn't have made it back into the transition in time to make it to the moon before all the program cuts. So Borman was wise to get out when he did, I think.
That's a whole other debatable thing, because when you think about it, Lovell was in rotation.
Lovell did get to 13. And
right, and if you read Cernan's book, Last Man on the Moon, he may not have been commander of Apollo 17 had Mike Collins accepted a command slot on a lunar mission, and he turned that down.
Not to mention Jim McDivitt, who I always thought was interesting that he left the program. I mean, he didn't leave the program. He took over the program, I believe, the astronaut office. But he didn't go back. He chose to get out of active flight rotation.
Right. Well, and again, that gets back to the fact that for him it was all about the test pilot aspect of it.
Yeah.
He wasn't an explorer. I guess it's fair to say. He didn't have that overriding ambition to get to the moon. The reason, like we said earlier, the reason he wanted to keep the flight was because it was a test pilot's dream. All the machines going out for the first time, doing their thing. After that point, landing on the moon is only secondary if you try to think of it from that standpoint. Of course, Dave Scott goes on to command Apollo 15.
Right. But if you think about it, interesting that that a test pilot. I mean, I guess as regular people, I guess we just don't get into the whole notion of thinking that as a test pilot, the ultimate is what as opposed to you would think that for, you know, you and I would give our IT to go to the moon. But
right, exactly.
For Jim McDivitt, it wasn't the thing.
Yeah.
It wasn't the thing. For him, it was a lot more fun to ring out the lunar module and make sure it worked.
Right, right. Well, and that's the goal of the test pilot, is to ring out the machine and then hand it over as a certified, you know, vehicle that you can fly. So,
whereas
yeah,
Dave
Scott. No, go ahead, Seth.
No, whereas Dave Scott went on to command the Apollo 15 mission to the one of my favorite locations, the Hadley Grill, Mount Hadley, where he landed and did a stand-up EVA in the lunar module, and then was the first to drive around in the lunar dune buggy, the lunar rover.
But also one who was one of the first to accept the challenge of the exploration. Again, you go back to a man on the moon. He was one who was sold by Lee Silver on the fact that test pilots already are great observers, and you just take that capability and turn it toward exploration as opposed to flying. So in that sense, Scott was, you know, he as contrasted to McDivitt, you know, Scott was an explorer. You know, he was looking to expand that body of knowledge. So, yeah, it's an interesting career that way.
Yeah, I've always been fascinated by the way astronauts think, and I know it comes from being a test pilot that they don't necessarily buy into the hyper emotionalism of the moment. I mean, I've heard so many times from all the astronauts that, you know, their mission was so booked and so stacked that the only thing that they could do was focus on their jobs. They couldn't really, you know, look around and smell the roses.
Mm-hmm, right.
And get caught up in the emotionalism of the moment. You know, you think of the fact that, and I'm digressing ahead into Apollo 11, but here they go through this big gigantic stress of landing on the moon, and you hear almost immediately after that they start running the checklist.
Yes, right.
You know, they're not whooping it up, they're not yeehaw or anything like that. You know, they just the next thing on the list. You know, and.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that for Apollo 9, it was the same. But I'm sure they had to have enjoyed a lot of that stunning orbital view. They took some pretty incredible pictures up in Earth orbit.
Yep. Let's see, what else do we have to say about this? Well, McDivitt, of course, he was commander of Gemini 4, which Ed White performed the first American spacewalk. It's interesting in that way because obviously it's early in the program, but he was the first commander of Gemini who had not previously flown a Mercury mission.
That's true, and you got to think that McDivitt had a lot on the ball. There's only two guys in the seat, and you know someone's got to be the commander, and there's two rookies there. But
right.
I mean,
but Gordo Cooper,
everybody else pretty much got paired
five.
Up. Yeah, I mean, I don't think, other than Neil Armstrong, I don't think anybody else was a rookie going in from Gemini. I mean,
right, as far as a commander. Correct.
Borman was a rookie commander, and so there's another one.
Oh, yeah.
But McDivitt was given two very, very important missions to command. I mean, you would think that maybe as, you know, to do the rookie flight, you might want to give them the mission they gave Borman, which was just spending 2 weeks up in space. But he was given the, you know, command of the first American spacewalk in Gemini 4, and then to test out the first lunar module to actually become man-rated. He had to man-rate the lunar module.
Yeah.
So that's a heck of a lot to do. They spent 10 days in low Earth orbit, and...
Well, the other thing to keep in mind, you mentioned earlier on that the mission profile is they flew, McDivitt and Schweikert flew the lunar module 111 miles from Gumdrop. And, you know, there's a distance, but when you think about it, what that meant was they were out of eyesight.
Right, and they had to,
so
they actually...
Yeah, it wasn't just like backing off at distance and then practicing the rendezvous. It was like they would experience it coming up from the moon. Don't see them, don't know where they are, and acquire the signal and make the docking. And
that would be the first testing of the rendezvous radar.
Right.
And so there was like 10 things that they really, 10 firsts, and most missions had maybe one, maybe two firsts, and they had a laundry list of firsts. But my favorite thing is when Schweikert is testing the Pliss backpack, he's actually standing on the porch of the lunar module in orbit. Dave
right.
Scott's taking his pictures, and I remember as a kid, I remember that because Dave Scott had that red helmet.
Yes.
And I always wondered why he had a red helmet.
Well, I wonder if that's similar to what they did with the red stripes on the commanders on the moon missions after Apollo 12.
Right, the commander was sitting in the lunar module. So,
I don't know.
That's a good question. But his camera breaks. And so he goes inside the command module to fix his camera. And Schweikert is just standing there with nothing to do. Probably the only time in the history of the Apollo program where an astronaut got to just goof off and just stop and smell the roses and just take in the view while the other guy gets his camera fixed. So that's an interesting observer. Let's go to the Apollo 9. The transposition and docking of the Apollo 9. If you're listening in, feel free to call in. Our number is 347-215-7847. Lines are open. And let's go to a clip of the Apollo 9 docking.
All right, Roger. It's out there, and we're turned around and proceeding with the station keeping and docking.
Oh, tremendous, Apollo 9. Thank you.
Command and service module has separated from the third stage, has turned around, and is now station keeping.
Bella.
Roger, copy that.
During this pass, the command and service modules did separate from the S-4B, the third stage of the launch vehicle. The spacecraft has turned around and the crew is now inspecting the lunar module, which is still inside the spacecraft LAM adapter attached to the S-4B. They'll continue this station keeping for another 10-12 minutes. Docking scheduled just about 3 hours over the Goldstone station.
And Apollo 9, Houston, we've got you through the Redstone, standing by.
Roger, Houston, we're about 25 feet now on the closing point.
Copy.
Houston, we're hard dock.
Roger, Apollo 9, understand, hard dock. Good show.
Reported hard dock at 302.08.
Apollo 9, this is Houston. You are go for ejection.
Roger, go for ejection.
Houston, Apollo 9.
Go, Apollo 9, this is Houston.
Oh,
sounds beautiful.
And that was a little bit of footage from the Apollo EVA. I believe we have Mike Smithwick with us. Mike, are you there?
I called in about 7:59 and just got in the queue. And what happened?
I don't know. Your number just popped up. This is a big experiment for us. So our apologies for not picking up on you right away. We were talking about Apollo 9. We had gotten to the transposition and docking and then talked about the EVA. What are your thoughts about the Apollo 9 mission?
I'll repeat or reiterate some of what Tim has said. I've just been sitting back here trying to jot down everything I wanted to say in response. One of the things that was I found interesting about the Apollo 9, and we already talked about it briefly, is that it was kind of one of the forgotten missions, I think largely because it came immediately after perhaps the most majestic space flight that was ever flown, which was Apollo 8. And since we'd already been in Earth orbit before, it was sort of a ho-hum mission, I think, from the standpoint of the public, even though it was still men in space and a very exciting and busy mission. Man, it would have been very, very hard to top Apollo 8 short of an actual landing on the moon. So I think Apollo 9 was, especially in the mission summaries and the high points of the Apollo program, tends to be forgotten a little bit. When it was definitely one of, it was at that point, was by far the most complex mission that ever flown.
Yeah, I know as a kid, the only thing that I remember, and I mentioned it before, was David Scott wearing that red space helmet.
And also, I think Schweikert had a red helmet, too.
And he did.
Why that may have been the natural color of the helmet underneath the insulation that was later applied for the lunar EVA suits.
Well, they certainly did. They certainly did do a lot. They did seven the tests of the SPS engine, which was the main engine of the command module. Seven. They burned it seven times, thereby proving that they could reuse it, turn it on and off as many times as they needed to.
And also, not too long after the docking, after they pulled the lunar module out of the S4B, is when shortly after they went into the lunar module for the first time, and they fired up that engine, the descent propulsion engine, while the two spacecraft were still docked, and to give it about a six-minute burn, I think it was, while the two vehicles were docked together, and one reason was to study the dynamics and guidance of this large, large stack they had now in orbit in the case of a possible emergency use of the lunar module descent engine for future Apollo missions. And as we know, that happened in Apollo 13.
Right.
Yeah, that's true.
The other thing that occurred to me listening to that and just kind of reflecting on it, and this I think is indicative of the Apollo program generally, is the knowledge that was gained on one mission seemed to be absorbed by osmosis on subsequent crews. In other words, now I know they did lots of simulator time, okay? I mean, it's probably the most simulated groups of missions in history. But the fact of the matter is, until you do it, you don't necessarily know. But the lessons learned on Apollo 9 served well for Apollo 10 and then on to 11 and 12 and so forth, so on. And, of course, in Apollo 13, like you just mentioned, Mike,
uh-huh.
You know, firing the stack with the lunar module descent. So it's interesting that all those lessons that were learned by any one crew were transmitted so that the next crew didn't have to relearn. Yeah, right. Didn't have to relearn what had already been learned. They were able to build on that.
And in fact,
go ahead, Mike.
And in fact, one of the earliest lessons from the mission happened during launch. McDivitt and Schweikert both loosened up their seat belts, their seat restraints, giving them a little more freedom of movement during the launch. But they loosened them up just a little bit too much. So when staging happened, they were both slammed ahead in their seats and came within about an inch of the control console.
Wow.
That's like that shot from Apollo 13.
Exactly.
Where they do staging and Kevin Bacon goes right into the camera.
Exactly. And also in Apollo 13, you remember when Gunnar Wendt helped strap them in, he puts his foot up on the seat and really tightens those suckers. That was a reason why they had to do that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, he probably could have cracked the helmet.
Not to mention, who knows what, and damage the control panel, and
yeah.
Probably that's the spot.
Exactly.
More than one, that would have been a bad day. But, you know, the Apollo 9 mission, like you said, you don't really remember a lot about it, but you know it was there. But when you look back on it, it's amazing how much they had to do, and yet it all went off pretty much without a hitch. Like we were saying, pretty much the only thing that went bad was the fact that Rusty Schweiker got sick.
That was NASA came in play for later studies. After Schweikert's bout with space sickness for about the next 6 months, he ended up being the designated space sickness guinea pig by all the doctors, and that was essentially his role, to deal with all these doctors and go through different experiments to find out exactly what triggered it and how you counteract it.
And what you're saying, Tim, about being able to build on every time they learn something new and being able to transfer it to the other crews, one of my favorite references when I study up for missions and all is to read through the Apollo debriefs that are available through Apogee Books, and how extensive the debriefs were as they took every beat of the mission and talked about it ad nauseum, and they were able to take all that information and put it into the simulations and put it into to make the simulations more real. So the simulations in the beginning of the program and the simulations in the end of the program were probably as different as night and day.
Certainly in terms of detail, I imagine so.
Do you have some thought on that, Mike?
I haven't read, I have the Apogee books, and I haven't opened it up for a long time, so I need to get back to that. But yeah, you're probably right. The debriefing was almost immediate after mission, so they could catch them with the freshest memory. And also a lot of times during the mission, they would debrief them on certain things. And certainly, again, the chest strap is one of those details that seemed small but could have resulted in a lot of damage to a mission had they not paid attention to that. And other things, just the way lighting might affect the spacecraft, the way the control layout might affect their guidance and the way they approach specific maneuvers. All those little details down to the tiniest detail would certainly have to be recorded and analyzed and then worked into future missions if necessary.
And once again, if you're listening in to the Deep Geek Live tonight, you want to call in and tell us your thoughts about Apollo 9, give us a call at 347-215-7847. Let's go to a clip of Apollo 9.
Yay. Where did it come from? Where did it come in? This is Spider. Okay, all depressed.
Wrong one. Hang on. Like I said, this is an experiment.
Where did it come from? Ahead, come in, this is Spider. Okay, all depressed and everything's looking good.
Please, Henry, will you open the door?
I haven't opened the door yet.
Okay. Don't lose anything when you do.
Okay, I'll try.
Be the goaltender, keep everything in.
Okay, Spider, gumdrop, the hatch is open, no sweat, just swing, pick it up.
Yeah, open swing back again now.
Oh, it stays just where I want it.
Yeah.
Right with it. Oh, gee, I'm glad we stopped here.
To pull down my visor.
Yeah, about to do it,
hasn't it? Yeah, it looks like it.
Hey, Mr. Spider, proceed out the door.
Hey, is your camera on there, CMP?
It's running.
Okay. Proceeding on out. Okay.
In the Gorma Suburbs.
Hey there.
Oh there, that looks comfortable.
Oh boy, what of you?
That's my Papa.
It really is. There's a moon right over there.
Boy, oh boy, what a view. How many times did we hear that on an Apollo EPA?
Not the most eloquent, but perhaps the most sincere. On the EVA, much of it made of Schweikert's space sickness almost canceling it. What triggered the space sickness, or when he first noticed it, was I think the day before when he was actually testing getting into the suit. And you need to be floating free and going through all sorts of contortions to fit into the space that you sort of crawled in through the back. And that's when it started up. You actually started feeling nausea about that time. And then, of course, for the rest of that day, he had it. And I think he vomited a couple of times. And then that night, they had already decided at that time to cancel his EVA, which was a vital part of the mission. And since in previous instances, the astronauts who got spacesick never told anybody because they thought it might affect their chances for future missions, Rusty was convinced he was the only guy ever had been spacesick before. And so he was kind of a space wuss. He was afraid he'd never fly again. And he was really sad that this was going to be losing his spacewalk. And so that night, he mentioned in an interview I recently heard that was the worst night of his life because he was going to be blamed for all these missed things because he just couldn't quite stand zero-G.
Well, especially when it seems throughout all the interviews that I've ever heard, it seems the number one thing that the astronauts all pretty much said was they were never afraid of dying. They were always afraid of messing up the mission.
Correct.
And so for him, I can imagine how horrible it felt that they were probably going to have to cancel the entire mission if he didn't get better. And how, you know, just how terrible that must have made him feel, and thank goodness that he did feel better.
Yeah, and they apparently decided, or Jim McDivitt, the commander, decided to go ahead with the EVA only a really short time, like 20 or 30 minutes before hatch opening. And so that was just a spur-of-the-moment thing to at least go ahead with a partial EVA, and Houston said, yeah, go ahead, but just for sunlight, for one half of an orbit. Initially, it was supposed to be about 2.5 hours, and so it ended up being about 30 or 40 minutes.
Yeah, and he was actually supposed to also do a transfer, an outdoor EVA transfer from the lunar module to the command module as a test to prove that they could do an emergency EVA to go from one to the other. But because of Schweikert's space sickness, they ended up scratching that test as well.
He actually started a bit of that. I don't think they were intended to do the entire transfer, but he got off. He took his feet out of the golden slippers and got about 4 or 5 feet above the porch, doing on the handrail. I think he's going to go partway over to the command module, but then Scott's camera's jammed up, and Scott couldn't get any footage needed for that, and so there's no point in going ahead with that part. So he just went back to the golden slippers.
Here's an interesting little factoid, at least according to Wikipedia. Does anybody know why the D in Jim McDivitt's name on the patch is red?
No.
You got me.
Okay. According to Wikipedia, it says the D in McDivitt's name is filled with red to mark that this was the D mission in the alphabetic sequence of the pre-lunar landing missions. The patch was designed by Alan Stevens of Rockwell International. So I didn't even notice it until just now.
I didn't notice it now until I'm looking at it, too.
Well, I don't have it in front of me, but I can't say it had ever jumped out at me.
When doing the mission planning, since they didn't necessarily have the mission numbering, or they could, or those mission numbers could be changed at any time, we actually gave major designators to the mission as letters of the alphabet. And so the C mission was Apollo 7. The D would have been the first lunar module test in Earth orbit. The E mission, which was subsequently canceled, was the original mission for the Borman crew, which would have been a high Earth orbit mission, essentially repeating Apollo 9. And after Apollo 9, it was so successful, they decided they didn't need that at all and just went ahead straight with, I think, the F mission, which was ended up being Apollo 10.
Right.
Yeah, which we will be talking about coming up in May, as the 40th anniversary of Apollo 10 will be May 18th, 1969. So look, coming up in about another 2 months for episode 4 of the Deep Geek Live, the Apollo 10 mission. So a couple of additional factoids from the Apollo 9 mission. The support crew for Apollo 9, not the backup crew, but the support crew, included Fred Hayes Jr., Jack Luzma, Edgar Mitchell, who was a guest of Conversations with Apollo a few months ago, and Alfred Warden. Boy, that's a heady group of guys. Those guys pretty much wrote the book on both the command module and the lunar module. Mm-hmm. And flight directors were Gene Kranz, the white team, Jerry Griffin, another Conversations with the top Apollo guest, and Pete Frank. I don't really know a lot about Pete Frank, other than he was a flight director. He was probably got the graveyard shift.
Yeah, I think that's typically the black crew that did nighttime shift.
Yeah, and, well, according to this, it was the white team, the gold team, and the orange team. But there you go.
Well, yeah, always one of those teams was the nighttime shift, and they just really didn't do anything. They were just to make sure that everything held together.
What other interesting pieces of thoughts? What other thoughts do we have on the Apollo 9 mission?
Well, one thought that occurred to me, we touched on it briefly with the LEM not having a heat shield and performing maneuvers in low Earth orbit, but I think we should amplify on that. And the fact that the LEM was truly the first vehicle designed for an alien environment. You know, there's no way that thing was meant to have any business near Earth, frankly. It was a creature of space, and it was a creature of the moon.
That's true. The very first one, and what I think is amazing is that the lunar module was designed and built by a company that had absolutely, pretty much, no experience in spaceflight. As far as, you know, when you go from McDonnell Douglas writing the book on building spacecraft, and then Grumman gets the gig for the lunar module.
Oh yeah, yeah, that was a big surprise too. Grumman had done high performance jet aircraft, but it compared to all the big guys like McDonnell Douglas or Lockheed or Boeing, Grumman was a small player, so it was a real shock. When all the other bigger companies lost out to them. A couple other notes here. First, the majority of the test objectives were met only halfway through the mission. After the free flight of the LEM and the redocking and casting Spider off, the other 5 days of the mission was actually very, very slow. I think it was probably due extended duration testing of the command and service module in orbit. But I go through the flight plan, and I see a lot of blank pages. It was actually very, very slow.
Huh.
So all the stuff is re-crammed up in front the first half of the mission.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at the basic timeline of maneuvers here, and it goes from T plus 28 hours for the fourth SPS test, and then there's nothing else until T plus 49. So they had almost a whole day where you could tell they were starting to stretch out the mission, and then they went T plus 54 hours for the fifth SPS test, and then nothing again until T plus 92, where they did the first CSM LEM undocking.
And
so clearly they were just ticking them off, and hey, we better slow down here.
And then afterwards, I think after undocking, they had another couple of engine tests, and the rest was just some photography of the Earth.
That's true, and they did have a lot of really great photography in space.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, there's absolutely beautiful pictures that they did take that really concentrated on that. Getting back a little bit to some of the first, one of the first, or really second, I suppose, excuse me, was the naming of the spacecraft. After Gemini 3 had been named Molly Brown by Gus Grissom, NASA didn't sort of frowned on the idea of naming spacecraft after that because they felt Molly Brown a little bit too silly for a serious mission like that. And Gus Grissom, of course, we knew his previous mission. He was the first astronaut to fly twice in space, and his previous mission, the spacecraft sunk, so he decided to throw caution to the wind and name his spacecraft after the unsinkable Molly Brown.
Right. Right.
And so afterwards, no Gemini spacecraft were ever named, and same for Apollo up until Apollo 9. And so one time, Schweikert and McDivitt were at a local restaurant after some training and trying to figure out, well, how would they identify the lunar module and the command module and Rusty when he was on his EVA, and they realized they really did need to use code names. And so instead of actually going to their bosses and getting permission, they just started using them. They made up Gumdrop and Spider and then Red Rover for Rusty, started using those code names in simulation. Pretty soon the mission controller started to pick them up, and that's how the naming was kind of sneaked in under the door.
Interesting.
Well, they pretty much kind of had no choice. I mean, how were they going to designate between the two if they didn't give them some sort of nomenclature? Otherwise, you know, Apollo 9, the next thing you know, they're got no, how, you know, both guys are answering at the same time.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, they could have used, you know, all right, Apollo 9 CM, go, Apollo 9 LM. You know,
we're talking about using A, B, and C as designators. So Apollo 9A might be the command module, and Apollo 9B would be the LEM.
But thank goodness that they did use, that they snuck that in. And even with the frivolity of Charlie Brown and Snoopy for Apollo 10, the fact of the matter is, you know, can you imagine Neil Armstrong going, Houston Tranquility Base, Apollo 11B has landed.
It just doesn't quite have the poetry.
Right, exactly. That's exactly right.
Yeah, but you know what? I as a kid, I loved it that Apollo 10 was named after Charlie.
Oh, of course.
And I have some interesting stuff to add to that, but we'll wait until Apollo 10.
Okay, great. we'll look forward to that. But no, but as
which
but
again
as,
will be in which again? Stay tuned. It will be this coming May.
Yeah.
May 2009, as we deep geek for the 40th anniversary of Apollo 10.
So the lunar module, Spider, the LEM descent stage, re-entered only about 10 days after they did. I think the descent stage re-entered about 10 or 11 days after they did, and the ascent stage re-entered in 1981.
Really?
Actually, re-entered in the fall of 1981. So Spider was still flying, or at least part of it, after the first space shuttle launch.
Wow.
Oh,
I did not know that.
This just in. Unfortunately, Mike Dim tried to get into the show tonight and was unable to make it. So he sent me an email saying, having tried registering to join in with Mike, I wish to apologize. This is our big experiment. We're going to have to wring out the little bit of details here to get people to call in. But if you get a chance, call in 347-215-7847. Just pick up the phone and call, and we'll put you on. But this is what Mike Dim has to say. Good day, James. I was actively involved with the tracking of Apollo 9. It was quite challenging, especially for our wing station. The DSN's DSS 42 at Tidbinibilia. Sorry about that, Mike. It couldn't move at Earth orbit tracking speed, so generally wasn't used during the mission, except when the CSM and the LEM were widely separated, and so out of the beam width of the HSK antenna. So we devised a plan whereby the acquisition aid of the DSS-42 with the 15-degree beam width was used. The antenna started moving ahead of the spacecraft, going as fast as it could, and successfully received a signal for most of the path. Mike did. So,
he also offers
that if you want to get a better quality of the show, use RealPlayer, which is amazing to me because I'm not much of a fan of RealPlayer. But if Mike says it's got better quality, I believe him.
There you go. Well, it's interesting comments from Mike, but I think that also just highlights how, in the face of the unexpected, that the crew, no matter where they were, whether on Earth or in orbit, managed to improvise in such a way that it got the job done.
Yeah, and let's face it, that has been the hallmark of just about every space mission, even right on down to the Mars rover missions of today, where they are able to deal with problems and create workarounds to keep missions on track and actually keep from scrubbing them, which is I've always enjoyed about the space program.
And that's where good engineering and good engineers come into play. Now,
indeed.
Apollo 9 was the launch of the third lunar module. The first lunar module flew on Apollo 5 as an unmanned test. And LEM 2 was apparently just so buggy, just had so many problems, they ended up never flying it. They decided to skip over and use LEM 3 for Apollo 9. LEM 2 is, Schleicher called, said it was destined to become a hangar queen, and it's currently the LEM that you see in at the Smithsonian.
Oh.
Guys, let me tell you, it wasn't until I actually was at the Smith and saw the lunar module that I realized just how stinking big it is.
Yes.
I mean, you don't really. I mean, you know it's big because you know it's big because you see the astronauts climbing down the ladder, but until you're actually standing there in front of it and it dwarfs you so dramatically, and it truly is amazing. And you think, well, the command module is just as big, if not longer. And you just realize how amazing it is that they were able to take such a large spacecraft and get it up into space and get it to the moon and then land it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's really amazing to see one of those things in person. And then, of course, you have the lunar module, the full-size LEM, down at the Cape hanging from the ceiling like a kid's model over the cafeteria.
Yeah, well, that whole display where they've got the whole Saturn V hanging from the ceiling is just awe-inspiring.
Oh, yeah, it really is. Now, another little tidbit I unearthed is that the Apollo 9 crew was the original backup crew for Apollo 1. And they ended up being shifted to another mission, assigned as the prime crew for Apollo 2, and then the Schirra crew came in as a backup crew for Apollo 1. And, of course, we know the Schirra crew ended up flying Apollo 7.
Well, that must have been a sober thought for them.
Oh, yeah.
Here's an email that I picked up from the Yahoo Apollo History group from David Woods, co-author of the Apollo Flight Journal. Hi, folks. I'm delighted to pass on the news that thanks to Andrew Vigneault, an Apollo 9 Flight Journal has begun to form just in time for the 40th anniversary of the mission. So check out the Apollo Flight Journal at history.nasa.gov/APO9FJ. And you'll be able to click on that, and it looks like they're currently covering the launch. They've got some really pretty much say play-by-play from everybody, all the astronauts, the public affairs officers, talking about it, talking the mission piece by piece. And the Flight Journal looks like I'm really excited that they're keeping the Apollo Flight Journal going. And that is courtesy of NASA and some very inspiring Apollo fans like David Woods and Mr. Vigneault.
And we were talking earlier about Earth to the Moon, or you were. I was just listening to it before you punched up my call. The Apollo 9 episode, Earth to the Moon, is always my favorite. I've had a couple of different books on the building and construction of the lunar module, and it's fun to see that depicted and all the little engineering troubles that they had and how they worked around them. I think one of the toughest, most interesting problems they had was with the ascent stage engine, a little bitty engine that needed to get these guys from the lunar surface back up to lunar orbit, certainly perhaps one of the most essential pieces of equipment on the LEM. And their engine, I forgot who was doing the original one, but it would just die after about every 5 or 10 tests. The engine would just go out. It would get in some sort of feedback mechanism inside the engine, and that would just shut off the flame the burning, which would not be a good thing if you're lifting off the moon. And so they had no idea what was going on, just a lot of seat-of-the-pants ideas, nothing more. So they ended up contracting with another company to build another engine, I think like RCA or some odd company, doing a second engine, hoping that between the two designs they could kind of work that one big bug out. And during the engine testing, one of the first things they had to do would be to reproduce the bug as far as, you know, which our software guys like myself always look for. And they determined they could actually start this oscillation by putting a little bomb inside the engine, the chamber, and blasting that off, and that would start the oscillation and the feedback. And so one time they're on the mission, on the flight going out to one of their other contractors, and you have these guys talking about rockets and bombs. And so when they got off the airplane, the FBI met them. So some flight attendant called ahead and did not like that kind of talk. And so
yeah,
I think they ended up taking designs of both of these engines, putting them together, and it just kind of worked.
Thankfully.
And that's very interesting. Here's another little factoid. Apollo 9 shares the distinction of being one of the only Apollo missions to actually have a song done by Adam Ant. Called Apollo 9.
Now those are the two names I would never expect to hear in the same sentence.
Apollo 9 and Adam Ant. Yes. And I had it, and I had it ready to go, and I have sadly misplaced it. So unfortunately, oh, wait a minute, I think I may have found it. So let's see if I can get a little bit of it playing here. Hang on. And there you go, Adam Ant with Apollo 9.
I need to track down a copy of that.
Yeah.
So in
yeah, I actually got it off of YouTube. It's got the whole video there. So with 2 minutes left to play in the game, what do you say we do a little bit of the Apollo 9 reentry?
Okay.
Ground circuit is strangely quiet. Just the crew getting into orbit deorbit attitude, some 3 minutes, 12 seconds away from deorbit burn. We'll leave the circuit open for any conversation.
Mark, 2 minutes. You're looking good.
Roger.
60 seconds, Mark.
Left in the ENR program. I just want to say thank you to my guest, Mike Smith, and Tim Callender, and again from email via Australia. This has been the Apollo Heat for Apollo 9. Audio clips courtesy of the Apollo Archive at apolloarchive.com.
Some 2 minutes away
and
from the
our theme music is Keeping Time with the Moon by Amy Fox. For more information for Amy Fox,
miles.
Visit her website at www.amyfox.com. Now let's finish up with
the
entry here. My name is Chris Rubo, and thank you for participating in
the
very first
Apollo 9 spacecraft came into the atmosphere. Main chute should be going out at this time. Recovery 3 helicopter has visual contact. And it's visually in sight from the carrier. big chair went up here in the mission operations control room as they saw it on the tube. Estimate now 3 miles from the ship.
You guys there?
Yeah, I'm here.
All right, that's it. That was our first episode.
All right.
I think that worked out reasonably well. Might be
the exception
good.
Of you, Mike. I'm really sorry.
It might be good next time to set up an AIM channel as well, so we can zip IMs back and forth in case there are any problems like that.
Yeah, that's a good idea. We should do that for next time. That would.
And I have a potential guest for you. You may want to track down coming up for the Apollo 10.
Ooh.
Oh, excellent! Who?
About 3 weeks ago, the Charlie Schultz Museum up in Sebastopol just opened up an Apollo 10 exhibit. It's really quite nicely done. And
where's that at?
In Sebastopol. It's kind of near St. Helena, Napa area, Marin County area.
Okay. Oh, the Charlie Brown Museum.
Yeah. And so on their opening day, Stafford and Cernan came by, and also several of the other people, two guys from the recovery crew, including the pilot from the main recovery helicopter was there, and a woman named Jamie Flowers. Does that ring a bell?
Jamie
this is really obscure. This is really obscure. And this is the kind of person I think you'd love to talk to. I wasn't present enough to get her phone number or email address, but I'm sure you could get it through the museum. One of the more famous pictures coming from the Apollo 10 mission is when the crew is walking out of the building and this young secretary there has a big stuffed Snoopy for them
oh,
to look
yeah.
at. Yes, that was Jamie Flowers.
Oh, I would love to talk to her.
And she was Scott Carpenter's or Gordon Cooper's secretary, I think is what she was at the time. And so she spoke a little bit and just signed autographs. And so I got her to sign my Apollo 10 flight plan next to a picture of Snoopy. And I completely blitzed, didn't get any contact information, but you could probably get it through the museum.
Yeah, I will definitely do that. I'll tell you who else I'd like to interview. I'd like to interview Dee O'Hara.
Yeah, I don't know if she's retired yet or if she still is out at NASA Ames. She was there when I was working out at NASA about 20 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, I just for the just the standpoint of talking about the whole thing about, you know, the how do I put this? Not enmity, but the rivalry almost between the flight director who could ground you, you know, for the littlest of things, and how, you know, my understanding is she ended up being quite the confidant. So,
gents, I gotta go. It's midnight for me. I have to.
Okay, Tim.
All right, Tim.
Pleasure as always.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, and we'll talk to you in May.
Okay. Talk to you then. Bye-bye.
And while I'm at it, let me give you the names of the recovery crew guys. You may want to get one of these guys on, too.
Okay, sure.
Chuck Smiley, he was the pilot for the helicopter.
Chuck Smiley?
Uh-huh.
For the Apollo 10 recovery?
Apollo 10 recovery off of Guadalcanal. Was it Guadalcanal? I don't remember. And Wes Chesser, who is one of the swimmers.
Oh, I'd love to get one of those guys.
Yeah, well, the guy you really want to get, I'm trying to remember his name, was Swim 1 for Apollo 11. He was the first one to talk to the crew. I heard him speak on the 35th anniversary up on the Hornet, on the USS Hornet.
Yeah.
Funny guy. I mean, he was really funny and very, very nice. And I think he actually lives in the area, in the San Jose area. He'd be a great interview.
That would be awesome. I would love to talk to those guys about the job that they did and how they were the first in contact and you know, what do you say? Welcome back, I guess.
When he knocked on the window of Columbia, and Armstrong, I think it was, kind of looked out and said something, but he couldn't understand what they were saying through the window. It was just whoa, 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 whoa. So the very first word spoken by Armstrong back on the earth was whoa, 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 whoa. And I think also talked about after the crew was in the quarantine van, the crew of the Hornet were under strict orders not to bother the astronauts. And so one, I don't think it was this guy, but he mentioned one of his friends, I think, was walking by the trailer, and there's a knock on the glass, and he looks, and there's Buzz Aldrin. And Aldrin's pointing down to the telephone on the outside, and so this guy picks it up, and Aldrin is just going stir crazy. He wanted just a yak of someone. And then a Marine guard comes over and picks the phone up from this sailor and apologizes to Mr. Aldrin for being bothered and hangs up on him.
You got to tell that story when the time comes.
Yeah, yeah.
That's pretty good. Hey, listen, I got to put my boy to bed.
Okay, I got to get dinner.
So I will. We will talk to you in. We will talk to you in May.
Okay, great.
All right, man.
Thanks a lot, James. Okay. Been a lot of fun.
Oh, and if you could just give me some notes on the show, because I really like having a live format for this.
Yeah, that was kind of fun. Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
I like being able to play the clips,
mm-hmm.
even though the audio, you know, Mike tells us the audio isn't that great, but I like being able to play the clips, and I like being able to. I like being able to go from there. So
the only audio, real audio problem that there was the song. I could hardly hear it. And then, when you're playing the splashdown clip, the audio was too high, so I had a hard time understanding you when you were trying to speak over it.
Okay.
All right.
Good. All right, Sean, thank you.
Okay, take care, James.
All right, take care.
And I'll send you down a list of these names so you can get the spelling correct.
Super. Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right, take care. Talk to you soon.